to Progressive.
And VIX stands for Vaccine Information Coalition. You're listening to Progressive Radio Network, the most listened to truth radio program in the world. The title of our show is What in the Cell is Going On? And we're on every Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern, which can be accessed live on the front page of prn.fm or later on the front page of our vacinfo.org website. My name is Renee, and my husband Gary will be joining to interview our guest today, Dr. Kendra Becker. Gary, she holds a degree as a ND naturopathic doctor is an integrated physician practicing for over 10 years. She is known as Connecticut's 4A specialist, which stands for asthma, autism, allergy, and atopy, better known as eczema. We will be discussing MTHFR and genetics with vaccine injury, and we welcome Dr. Becker.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
We're excited to have you. Can you explain to our audience, Dr. Becker, what MTHFR is?
Absolutely. So MTHFR is a gene that codes for an enzyme, and it stands for, the initials stand for something I don't think you can say on the radio, but in our world, it is an enzyme that's called methyl tetrahydroxyfolate reductase. And this enzyme actually helps convert folic acid, which is synthetic, it's like a pharmaceutical basically, into a usable form of folate called methylfolate, which is basically like the gasoline for our cells. So the reason that there's been so much research and, you know, focus on MTHFR as of, you know, probably the last 10 years is because we're learning that, interestingly enough, we're seeing this not only in the autism population, but in the eczema population, for, you know, women particularly that struggle with infertility, and also anybody that has any kind of impaired ability to detox. So, you know, when we talk about vaccine injury, I mean, what are we really seeing if you kind of look at it in an overgeneralized fashion? But people that have the inability to be able to clear these toxins from their body, then because of that, what happens is they get stuck in the brain and the central nervous system and create a whole lot of damage and problems for those individuals.
Can you please explain to the audience, to Dr. Becker, how that affects the filtration system of the liver and also the liver functioning?
Sure, absolutely. So, as you know, the liver functions in basically two phases, phase one and phase two. So phase one takes all of the what we call exogenous toxins or toxins from our environment and turns them into things that are basically more toxic than what we were exposed to. From that phase one, they get transferred into phase two, where those, you know, super toxins get bound to salts and then are eliminated through the body. So the way I always explain it to my patients is, in order to get from phase one to phase two, you have to open that like airtight super locked door that you see at the bank or the vaults and things like that. The key to that particular door that's very, very strong and powerful are these B vitamins that are impaired in people that have challenges with MTHFR. And so that's why there's been so much discussion and research around this particular enzyme.
Good. And also, too, have you got a chance to do any research on the other filtration systems, like the amino acid conjugation phase, the sulfonation phase, the glucuronation phase of the liver, and how that works with the methylation?
Well, sure. I mean, methylation, you know, is really the foundation of all of those pathways you just mentioned, sulfonation, glucuronation, all of it. And so if there's kind of a hitch in your giddy up or, you know, a stick in your cogwheel and methylation is impaired or halted, none of those other detox pathways are going to work properly. You're absolutely correct.
Absolutely. Yeah, I find that in my practice too, that with a liver not functioning correctly, it can affect up to 500 different functions. And people, they look at the liver as just being a filter organ, and it regulates the glucose phase. It manufactures the bile salts, which work with the gallbladder. So it's amazing how one organ can be affected with up to 500 different functions.
Oh, you're absolutely right. You're speaking my language.
So how does vaccine injury play the role here?
Yeah. Well, so isn't that the $64,000 question? So we'll start kind of from the middle of the beginning, right? And so, you know, so I've been in practice 13 years. And when I first started, looking at the whole genome would cost a patient about $1,500, right? Mm. So now we can get a whole genome with a coupon, for like $49. So, you know, in the last decade, we've really, you know, evolved pretty profoundly. So in that period of time, we've been able to, you know, do a lot of data collection. Certainly also in that period of time, interestingly enough, I'm going to just focus for 1 minute on autism, because we know vaccine injuries are larger than autism, but this is a great example. So in autism, everybody's always running around looking for this autism gene. And as we know through research, there isn't one particular gene, because autism is largely environmental. However, what we did find in the research, particularly over the last decade, is 98% of individuals who are diagnosed with autism have an MTHFR gene mutation. So we can't say it's 100%, and we're not calling it a direct cause and effect, but we certainly do know that MTHFR plays a role in autism. Now, backing up a little bit to talk about vaccine injury, I mean, if we're just talking about, it's kind of like if you go to the gas station and you put diesel in your car that takes gasoline. You know, you're at the right place, you have the right intention, but you put all the wrong stuff in your machine and you're going to have a big mess. And so that's kind of how I look at MTHFR, you know, challenges, particularly with vaccine injuries. You may have all the right constituents, but they're in all the wrong places and the body doesn't know what to do with it. And so now everything has to be cleaned and and put back into balance.
Can you please tell the audience what the glutathione has to do with that pathway?
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, in order to cell signal, in order to get the proper signaling for glutathione, you need to have a properly working methylation cycle, and you need to have B vitamins that are bioavailable inside the cell. And I think, as you know, Gary, it's probably where a lot of challenges come for physicians and families, is they go and have a bunch of lab work done and they see, oh, a serum B12 level looks, you know, normal on lab work, or a serum folate level looks normal on lab work. And that's all well and good, but that's not really going to help us when we're talking about what our bodies need in order to make particularly glutathione. Because that we need that to be signaling inside the cell. So we got to get that serum B12 or that serum folate inside the cell for proper cellular function. Now, glutathione is basically the only function that we really care about that the cells make. Oh, that's not entirely true, but it's one of the major functions of every cell in our body, and it's the only thing that we have cellularly to be able to protect ourselves. If we have impaired or deficient methylation pathways, we are not going to make glutathione properly. So when, you know, you're in the very cool over 40 club, it becomes kind of like an anti-aging challenge. More glutathione that your body can make, you know, through any kind of, you know, whether it's food or exercise or whatever, the better we are, because it will help with anti-aging. However, when you think about it, as humans, we age from basically the day we are conceived. Once we become a two-cell organism, we begin to age. So aging is a profound issue or challenge for our cells from, you know, the second that we are conceived. If we are not making glutathione properly, we are not preserving and healing our cells properly. And this becomes a huge problem, particularly with vaccine injury, as you know, because it's the glutathione that actually helps heal our cells.
Does the method of delivery have anything to do with that, as far as whether it comes through the blood through injection or orally through the mouth?
Well, I think it depends on the patient in a lot of cases, because, you know, I mean, there's what, 4 billion genes in the genome, and about 4,000 of them separate us from apes, and, you know, about 400 of them affect our health. So every patient is a little different, and some patients can't tolerate an oral form of glutathione. Some can't tolerate an IV form. Some can't tolerate glutathione in any form. And so what you have to offer for those patients is you have to give them the components so their body can make their own glutathione. So I think that's a very individualized thing based on what patients need. And of course, too, we're talking about age of patients. You know, I have adults who can swallow, 16 or 18 pills a day if they need to, but you try to get a 4-year-old to do that, right, and, you got another thing coming. So I do think it can be individualized, and certainly looking very specifically at genetics can make a huge difference as to what, we can do as physicians to be able to help kind of pinpoint and precisely make recommendations for healing for those patients.
Have you found the toxic adjuvants in vaccinations and injection affecting that pathway?
Oh, absolutely. And aluminum is one of the biggest ones. It's not really just, the problem with vaccines in general, or really any injectable medication, is you're bypassing any normal physiologic pathway that the body would innately have in order to protect itself, right? Because if you inject something right into a muscle or into a bloodstream, you're missing any kind of protective ability. So using something like aluminum, which also can enter the body through food and through, topical agents and whatever, but injecting something like aluminum, which is a very popular adjuvant in vaccines, can create huge problems with, number one, if an individual is positive for MTHFR, which exists in 60% of our population, or if a patient has any kind of imbalance in their immune system, or if there's some sort of cell signaling trigger that causes an inflammatory response. Because we know, particularly in children, as their immune systems are really immature, you're going to get an immunologic overshoot if there's something that the body is receiving that it doesn't like a vaccine, for example. And all of that inflammation is going to basically be, centered in either the gut or the brain.
And what are your thoughts of the fact that we've been vaccinating since the late 1700s and generational vaccine damage even being linked to the MTHFR expression?
So one of my most favorite, it's kind of a hobby. We'll call it a hobby because I don't make any money doing it, but I love looking at medical history and some of these things, and of course, I've studied homeopathy as a naturopathic physician and, you look at these things called miasms, right? Which are basically generational, illnesses or generational traits that exist from generation to generation. Mm-hmm. And yes, I mean, there's definitely, vaccine injury that is carried through generations. And so one of the things that absolutely has been very well studied, even just in the last, 50 or so years, is they do believe, the researchers do believe, that MTHFR has been turned on or expressed in people to actually prevent and mitigate toxicity. And so that's what I find to be really, really fascinating, because MTHFR is almost 100% present in Mexican populations. Mm-hmm. And, what do we see there? I know when I lived in Southern California, I used to go on medical mission trips every other month, and we would go over the border into Mexico and do cleft lip and palate surgery on these children. Cleft lip and palates are a huge indicator that there's an MTHFR problem, right? Because it's a midline defect that happens in the center of the body, which is where the MTHFR enzyme, it comes down during conception and development. Mm-hmm. So in Italy, almost 100% of the population there also has MTHFR. Their diet is a lot of grains, right? So you have lectins and phytates and things that create inflammation. So it's really fascinating to kind of look at, the different populations across the world to see where this gene started to express itself and how we are seeing it now almost in an epidemic. Because really, having a gene, our genes don't define us, right? Having a gene is, it is what it is. It's whether or not you're turning it on or expressing it in a way that can be damaging to your health. And that's really where the challenge comes from.
Sure. I'm going to kind of switch gears here. In your research, what is the main factor of the epigenetics and versus just the genetics? And I call it the Calvin Klein theory. It's in the genes. Mm-hmm. And we've been told that through decades now, that it's in the genes. It's in the genes. You there's nothing you can do about it. So explain to the audience what the difference is between the epigenetics, that's Bruce Lipton's research,
right,
and the biology of belief, and then also the genetic research, just a physical gene.
Sure. So as we know, like genetically, like I said, MTHFR exists in about 60% of the population in America, number one. So having those genetics, again, does not define you. You can, and I always use my grandmother, who was an Italian immigrant, as a perfect example. Looking at her genes on paper were absolutely terrible. But the lady lived to be 96. She took one medication, largely because my aunt made her. She wouldn't have. She died the same body weight that she was the day she graduated from high school. She ate a ton of green vegetables and she walked almost every day of her life. So there is a perfect example that genetics are one part and the epigenetics, which is basically the environmental expression, is far another. So, and that's what I think is the main take home point here, is that we all can be dealt with, you know, we can't control what our parents gave us from a genetic perspective, but what we can control are all of these other things in our environment. We can choose to live away from Wi-Fi towers. We can turn our Wi-Fi off at night. We can eat organic food. We can cook in cast iron. We can, you know, make our own products that we put on our skin from food, from things that we would only put in our mouth that are food. And so that's what, you know, I really want the take home message to be. And that's one of the beauties and most amazing things about naturopathic medicine is you are in control of your own healing. And any doctor that's going to tell you that, you know, you've been dealt a crappy hand of genes and there's nothing you can do about it, you know, really needs to go back to medical school and take another hard look, because I do believe that we have total control over what we can do with our own healing. And I think that's a huge message for those of us who have had, you know, or experienced vaccine injury, because it can be such a long road.
Absolutely. Yeah, a lot in my practice here, a lot of the people, they say that, you know, it's in the genes and the doctor says that I have nothing I can do about it. But as soon as we changed the diet and we got them on juicing and the phytonutrients and the rich antioxidants, pathways enrich the liver right away, and then by kicking up the pH from acid to alkaline, and by modulating the immune system, the expression on the genes changed, no matter what genetic factor that they had. So we actually can prove that the genetics are very small ratio in comparison to the epigenetics of what 100%. You're thinking,
yeah,
and also what you're thinking, what you're speaking. What's been said to you that day, what you said to another person that day, expresses the genes negatively or positively.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I totally agree with that.
As far as the vaccine injections, have you done any studies on what the mercury is doing at all, or what the polysorbate 60 or the other adjuvants that they're using in the vaccines?
Oh, yes. There's tons of research that I have reviewed about that. But again, right now, as you know, it's really aluminum that's really the buzzword. And then the other thing, too, that's being studied very widely currently is all of the other non-human and sometimes human DNA that are found in these vaccines, because it is just not physiologically normal for humans to, again, have that kind of DNA bypass their, you know, their GI system in any other ways that it would normally enter the body. And that's what we're seeing, is creating these huge, you know, cytokine storms and autoimmune challenges, even, you know, and that's why we're seeing these things, in my opinion, in much lower and lower, you know, age brackets with children, you know, with all the autoimmune disease and chronic illness and things like that.
Right. Now, also, too, the audience needs to know the method of exposure to vaccines, the injection versus oral, is huge, because most of the immune system's in the gut. So you have to swallow or go through the epithelial lining or the cilia hairs in order to get into the gut-associated lymphoid tissue. So 70% of your immune system or more is in the gut. And so there's a gut relationship to the skin, which I'm sure you've seen in your eczema patients.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And then also there's a gut relationship to the brain as far as brain fog, concentration, cognitive thinking. So can you explain to the audience what the ratio of the gut to the skin or the gut to the brain is, and explain more?
Absolutely. So, and it's funny. So most of my patients today, it's ironic that I saw this morning before this interview, were all eczema patients. And this was the same conversation I had over and over again, which is wonderful. It's my favorite. So, but, and I do explain it very, very simply to my patients. If you have eczema or some sort of inflammatory, you know, condition in your skin, right, we know you have leaky gut. And because of all the microbiome research that we've seen in the last 5 to 7 years, we also know that the same microbiome microbiome that exists in your gut, which is as unique to you as your fingerprint, is the same microbial covering or same microbiome that we have in the brain. So if we have leaky gut, and we're seeing that in our skin or in as it manifests in asthma or hives or anaphylactic reaction or whatever it is, then we have that same reaction going on in the brain, but it ends up being an itch you can't scratch. So, you know, think about that mosquito bite that you had underneath your tight pant leg and how distracting that was for you. You know, can you imagine if that was inside your brain? I mean, it would make people absolutely nuts. And I think that's part of why we're seeing, you know, these epidemics in depression and anxiety and oppositional defiant disorder and all this other stuff is it's just, you know, this huge epidemic of leaky gut / leaky brain that is just caused by a cytokine storm from exogenous toxins that shouldn't be in the body for sure.
Has there been any common denominators that you found between the four A's that you actually deal with the asthma and the allergies and the autism and the eczema?
So in many cases, it can be a vaccine allergy, a vaccine injury. I've seen that very, very frequently in my practice. There's a lot, there's always some environmental component, you know, in some patients, it's a small one, in other patients, it's a large one, but the environment is a huge factor. And then there are all these, you know, these other things that I've seen, you know, littered throughout my career, like, you know, the families, interestingly enough, that live under, you know, cell phone or Wi-Fi towers in their town, that can be a huge implicator for some. I've had families that have lived in areas that had the toxic kind of chromium or the or lead in their or radon, because I'm here in the Northeast, in their dirt, and so that can be an environmental issue or factor for some of these kids. But you know, as you know, with anything that is gut and immune related, almost 100% of the time, it is a very, very unique trajectory for healing and a unique, you know, kind of healing plan for that patient because you're just not sure what their bodies can tolerate.
Yeah, in your practice, then, what do you use naturally for immunizations? Because I know you can't say vaccination is immunization. They're totally separate entities. So what are you using in your practice for natural means of immunizations?
So because I'm not a primary care doctor, and in Connecticut, you have to be a primary care doctor in order to, you know, quote, give a vaccine. But, you know, when you work with gut healing, I mean, basically what you're doing, just like you had said earlier, is that, you know, 70 to 80% of your immune system is developed in your gut. So as long as you're keeping the gut healthy, as long as you are giving it a nutritious diet and allowing for, you know, the right components and constituents in food as the building blocks for these things that the body needs to develop to boost and balance the immune system and heal and seal the gut, that works to be, I think, in my opinion, a much better way to, quote, you know, keep the immune system balanced. Because, you know, as you know, even if you were immunizing somebody naturally, right? And you boosted their cytokines in a way that their body wasn't comfortable with or created some level of inflammation, that still could be detrimental for the patient. So, you know, giving the body the proper building blocks in whatever that looks like for that patient, sometimes it's food, sometimes it's supplements, I think tends to be a much more gentle way for that body to heal and a much more concise way for that body to heal as well. So I think there's, you know, there's a lot of options.
Awesome. As far as the vaccine injections in mainstream medicine, explain to the audience that the antibody titer increase that they're getting from that, the histamine storms or the cytokine storms, have nothing to do with confirmed immunity, the antibody.
Yes. Yeah. You're absolutely right, and I think it's interesting because in some cases you're seeing antibodies that are quite high. Like in some of my autistic kids in my practice, I see very, very high antibody titers for measles, for example, and sometimes they're not existent at all for mumps. And so what you're really seeing there is you're seeing how that body is reacting from an immune perspective to that antigen being in the body. So it's not really an indicator of the fact that you're immune to anything, period, end of story.
Right. It just means you've been exposed to it. Mm-hmm. I use an analogy, you know, somebody walks into an elevator who's got mono, and then two more people walk in, the door shuts, and the guy with mono sneezes on both of them. So equal exposure to the germ. They both go home to the hospital and get their titers run, and they both have high titers to mononucleosis. But it doesn't mean they're going to get it. It just means they've been exposed to it.
Correct. Correct. You're absolutely right.
In your practice, though, what common denominators are you seeing in all the diseases as far as, you know, pH, immune system suppression, nutritional deficiencies, you know, things like that?
Mm-hmm. Yes, all those. So, and you know, what I see, you know, of course I have a wide range of patients, but certainly, you know, I always say above and beyond, as you know, across the board, alkaline diet, right? I mean, we knew from 1930 that, you know, cancer can't grow in an alkaline environment. So we always try to strive for an alkaline diet. I do see a great deal of gut permeability and gut challenges. Now, whether that be from a genetic predisposition, whether that be from a vaccine injury, whether that be from too many antibiotics or too much exposure to something that the body couldn't tolerate, it's hard to really say. So, you know, probiotics can be very, very beneficial in conditions like that. You know, I also see too, like you said, you know, just this immune system imbalance. Sometimes secretory IgA is very low. Sometimes secretory IgA is very high. Sometimes IgE is very high. So depending on where that patient comes in the door, you know, depends on what you're seeing. But I would say as a generalization, I would say it's probably some sort of gut permeability or deficiency and some sort of inflammation component along with that gut permeability or insufficiency, which of course is what you get, right? So if you have gut permeability, you're going to activate a tertiary mechanism to be able to protect the body. Humans have a really high vital force. So if you can't, you know, fix what you're looking for, you know, by swallowing food, mounting a reaction, which is part of digestion, then what you're going to end up doing is activating high levels of chronic histamine that then end up creating furthermore gut permeability, problems in the brain, and a whole host of physical symptoms that then have to be, quote, managed, right?
Yeah. Have you seen any specifics to what type of vaccine, whether it's MMR, DPT, smallpox, whatever it is there any specific vaccines that you're seeing that's going to cause the dysbiosis or the leaky gut?
So the correlations, even in my own office, as well as on research, are that day one hepatitis B, there's a very, very high correlation with eczema. And that seems to be pretty consistent across the board in my practice. I also have seen some consistencies with injectable vitamin K at birth and anaphylactic peanut allergies. And those two things have been pretty consistent across my practice. You know, the rest of them are all kind of willy-nilly. You know, of course, there's all the stories. We've all heard all of the stories. Of course, you know, there isn't the research because nobody bothers to do the studies for us on, you know, really what's this exact trajectory that these kids have, you know, low grade otitis media or allergies, and then they get that MMR at 15 or 18 months, and then we see a regression for autism. So, you know, we know that exists. I see it regularly. And, you know, when those kids come in the office, the first thing we do is we start a really, really, you know, aggressive gut, you know, permeability. You know, we try to remove the gut permeability really quickly and get those kids back to recovery.
What kind of probiotics are you using to culture the gut with the Acidophilus, the Bifidus, the Salvarius, the Planetarium? Because there's many species of the probiotics that can be introduced.
Are you there? All right. Where did we leave off? I was on a roll.
I have one question for you. How do they justify giving little children hepatitis B vaccines within 3 hours of birth when it's a bloodborne pathogen?
Oh my gosh, I know. I believe me, sometimes it feels like you're David and we're fighting Goliath. Some of these things are just, I mean, there's so much, you know, that's a whole nother, you know, week's worth of shows. There's so much, you know, politics and, you know, pocket lining that goes on with all this. And some of it's just, it's really on the backs of our children who are now the guinea pigs. It's terrible. And it doesn't make any physiologic sense. And that's what makes me the most irritated. Because when you think about these things logically, science aside and everything else, like, why would you ever do that? And so it just doesn't make any sense.
And not trust the body's innate ability, right? Because, you know, I teach people in my presentation that I did my own clinical study, because my first one, Casey, who I lost, who was fully vaccinated, you know, for 2 years, my son, Corey, who was 20 months old when she passed away with no vaccines, mm-hmm. I saw with my own two eyes the difference. Mm-hmm. I mean, he would run a fever for 10 minutes and kill, the year before she passed, a virus that she spent a week in the hospital killing.
Yeah.
So nobody's going to convince me that vaccines strengthen the immune system. If anything, they compromise the immune system.
I know. It's so funny. And what I think is the most interesting, because, you know, all we can do is educate, right? All right. we can do right. is meet people where they're at. So if they want studies, we can produce the studies. If they want logic, we certainly can have a discussion about logic. But yeah. nobody can make that decision unless that light bulb goes on in their own head. And so I had an experience the other day with a beautiful couple and their child. He was a very early preemie. I want to say he was like 23 or 24 weeker. And so he had all of the vaccines, and then they kind of held off for a little while, and their pediatrician had started pressuring them about, you know, continuing the series. So they basically caught the kid up, you know, they boosted him with everything. And so the father came to me and he goes, you know, my son's been sick ever since he got that last round of boosters. And he was perfectly fine since then, even with the lung disease from, you know, being such a micro preemie. And I was like, well, you know, I said, maybe, you know, at this point we can just move forward with boosting his immune system naturally. And the dad was like, yeah, that's definitely what I want to do. So it's like, you know, it's just hard, you know, when people kind of come to that aha moment after the fact, you know.
Right.
Yeah, and that's why we feel the education is so imperative, because, you know, most people just don't know where to go other than their pediatrician. Me, for an example, as a victim, you know, her dad, Casey's dad, walked in from a chiropractic office he worked at and said that they told us, you know, to look into the vaccines. And my response was, I would never be a negligent mother and not vaccinate. If, you know, that's why our cards are so important. We send them out all over the world for free, showing not only the website with all the facts for them to educate themselves, but also showing the poisons in the vaccinations. We just don't know this stuff. Education's imperative.
Oh my gosh, you are 100% right. To that end, it's having that individual relatable conversation with people one-on-one. And so it is so hugely time consuming, but so very, very important.
So important. And then back to the eczema, I want to discuss with sure. you too, because obviously I was vaccine injured, because I had not as many, of course, but I definitely had the shots that I got when I was a baby. I'm 54, almost 54 now. But that was definitely the bad expression for eczema, because I had eczema so bad as a child, like in school, that I couldn't even open up my hands. I would get cuts on my hands so bad. Well, Casey, the one that I lost, she had eczema really bad all over her body. And of course, the vaccines, I'm sure, exacerbated that. But now Faith, a little girl I've had since Casey's passing, who has no vaccines, I literally home birthed her and everything. She's never even been to a doctor. She's 18 now. She is experiencing severe eczema on her hands. She showed it to me just a couple days ago. I mean, cuts and everything. She's a smoothie maker at LA Fitness, and she can't even grab stuff. She says, Mommy, it hurts so bad. Mm-hmm. And I know with us, she eats clean, but I share them with their dad, who she does not get, you know, clean foods all the time. So definitely diet is the cure for sure. You know, we immediately put her on the probiotics and healing the gut, like you said, the leaky gut. But what is your thought about that? The fact that she's not vaccinated and she has such a severe eczema.
So my first thought is she's probably positive for MTHFR.
Right. Wow. And that was passed down from me, do you feel?
Well, yes. So if a child has MTHFR, if they have two copies, one copy came from mom and one copy came from dad. Okay. If they have one copy, then one parent passed it along the way. So, and that's very common, even in my practice, which is a large amount of unvaccinated children, is that, you know, you still have, you know, we all have a toxic bucket, right? And we all fill our toxic bucket each day with a drip, drip, drip. And so one day that toxic bucket is going to fill up and tip over, and that's when you're going to see a health challenge. Now, as we know with eczema, It's a very preservative reaction to the body. So we know that there is internal toxicity that the body is warning us about, and it's pushing us out into our skin. So we have to look at it every day and make a change. So, you know, what I tell my patients who say their story is just like yours. And they say, I never vaccinated my child. I home birthed them. I breastfed them for 45 years. How do they have eczema? I feel like a failure. And so it's not that at all. It's that there's some other level of toxicity that that child or that individual is being challenged with. And that can be very common. So what I would say first is, you know, definitely get tested for MTHFR and look at what the mutation is. The second thing you can do is you can actually support the body with B vitamins if it's tolerated. Because as you know, the B vitamins, like we talked about, is the key to opening that door. So if we can get that door open and we can get those toxins that are in the liver from phase one into phase two so they can be eliminated from the body, we should see very, very, you know, quick and easy results with clearing that eczema. Interestingly enough, I've had the same challenge with my own kid who's 12, and her eczema is also on her hands. And so that's exactly what we do. You know, you have to look at it. Is it an oxalate problem? Is it a lectin problem? So even though her diet may be very, very clean, it could be something in the foods that she's eating because her gut's out of balance.
Yeah, no, she's definitely not eating clean when she's with her dad, which is predominantly, especially now we're traveling. But it's really, really, really bad. And she hasn't did our cleanse either. We have my husband has developed a 21-day deep cellular flush that we put everybody on, whether it's cancer or diabetes or whatever it is, always first to clean up the cells. Because what we teach is that it's like trying to eat a meal with your hand over your mouth. Our cells are so caked with toxins we've been injecting, eating and breathing, drinking our whole life. Mm-hmm. She's never did that cleanse. She's always told me, Mom, I don't want to lose more weight. No, but she's now starting to have the idea of doing it. But we have to get her on the cleanse for sure and change her diet because, like I said, she doesn't really eat clean. She doesn't take care of herself for sure.
See? And there you go. I want that cleanse. What are you talking about? but you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, even those of us who spend, you know, a lifetime, right, always taking care of ourselves can still have these challenges. And so, you know, a 21-day cleanse like the one you offer sounds wonderful, even for just somebody who's, you know, really good at health maintenance.
Oh, absolutely. Him and I do it 3 or 4 times a year. And, you know, just take a break, let the juicer do your organs job. It's not necessarily a juice only fast, although one time we did do just juicing because some of our patients in the Carolinas had chose not to eat anything. And that was the deepest one we've ever had. My eyesight even got sharper after that cleanse. It was a huge difference. But it generally, the cleanse, the manual says that starting the third evening, you can have a big salad and then it's just 2 organic vegetable juices with the raw meal, the remainder of the cleanse. But it's an all raw diet the whole entire time. But everything changes. Your eyes, when you strip the cells and take that hand out from over the mouth, I mean, your eyes, your skin, your hair, people will look at you and they'll say, "What? You know, you're glowing." It's an amazing feeling the way that your body gets from the cleanse. So it's important.
Oh, but it's interesting, awesome. Dr. Kendra, is we're automatically addressing the gut. We're addressing the probiotics. We're addressing the liver enzymes, all of the pathways of the liver. So what it's really doing is actually enhancing the filtration systems of the liver and also building up the probiotics and building the genome, you know, the gut genome.
Oh, so here, let me tell you a little funny story. So when I first started practicing naturopathic medicine, I was like the 60-something practicing naturopath in Connecticut, right? My previous career, I was a nurse in Southern California, where the hospital system I was working in was the number one employer of female nurses in Southern California. Yeah. So I go from being a nurse, where everybody knows what a nurse is and what they do, to being this naturopathic physician, right? Mm-hmm. So you go from that conversation of, oh yeah, to what the heck is that? So, which was kind of how my career started, right? So when you start as a naturopath and nobody knows what you do or how you do it, you end up getting everybody else's failures, right? Everybody that's seen 6 or 7 doctors and they don't know what's wrong with them and this, that, and the other thing. So I'd have all these patients come in the office that I didn't even really have a comprehensive understanding of their disease process. And so I was like, well, you know, I learned in naturopathic school, we treat the liver and we treat the gut. Right. And so a couple months later, these patients would come back and they'd feel better. And I'd be like, right. Wow. Mm. And so then, you know, as you evolve in your career and you realize that medicine and any other career that anybody's really impassioned about is so self-directed and the learning never stops. And so here I am 13 years later doing the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. It's just now I have a much more deeper understanding and excitability about the biochemistry and biophysiology behind it. But it's the same thing. I mean, like you said, we treat the liver, we treat the gut, we balance the microbiome, which then in turn balances our immune system, which then in turn balances our body's ability to make proper neurotransmitters and react appropriately to situations. It's all connected. Absolutely.
What made you go from nursing, which is more pharmacological type knowledge, to jump ship to go to naturopath?
Well, I was in Southern California, which was really at the time, you know, the heart of the holistic movement. Sure. It wasn't branded, you know, it wasn't marketed that way, but it was like, you know, it was a very practical kind of, oh, you don't feel good? Well, go surfing for 3 hours. Oh, you don't feel good? Go, you know, go run on the beach. And it was just kind of this very organic way of healing. You know, I worked in a trauma center. We didn't even have a scale for patients that weighed over 300 pounds. It was like the Wild West, you know? And during my career, what happened was they rolled out HMOs. Remember the old HMOs? Yeah. So I was working in a trauma unit. I was working in a cardiac ICU. And so what would happen in the good old days is, you know, remember fax machines and paper charts and things like that. Your patient would come up on the floor and you would get faxes from the ER, which would have all the admission paperwork for your patient. Well, as my career evolved, what happened was you'd walk up to the fax machine and you would get admission paperwork and discharge paperwork at the same time. Nobody ever saw the patient. And so that was really my aha moment when I realized that people were coming into the hospital and they weren't getting better. They were getting sicker. And it was the same, you know, particularly in the cardiac ICU, it was chest pain, rule out MI, have a cardiac cath, have a purple pill. And then you basically waved goodbye and said, I'll see you in 3 months. And so it was then when I realized that there had to be a better way to help people with healing than to just, you know, kind of put a Band-Aid on it and you know, say a little prayer and hope for the best. And so that I literally ran. I quit my job without notice. I didn't even give them 2 weeks notice. Nice. Ran out of the hospital to become a naturopathic physician.
Wow. I'm glad you did that.
Yes, we're very glad you did that.
Me too.
Where do you get the THFR gene testing or the testing they're talking about? Where do you get it from?
So you can, any old doctor can order it on a blood work. So if you're going to see your primary care physician and you have a physical scheduled, you can ask them to just add it on to their standard blood work. Now, or if you don't want to involve a doctor at all, you can do any one of these, you know, genetic testing kits that are offered online for $49, $59. And you can actually comb through your own genome, which I really think everybody should have access to, and be able to find the gene itself.
Wow. And then what do you do to repair it? Or what are you doing?
Well, it depends, you know, like for me. You know, with my MTHFR mutation, interestingly enough, I'm what's called methyl sensitive. So I don't tolerate high levels of B vitamins. So I have to be very, very careful about how I support my body. So what I've done is all the stuff I recommend to my patients, which is heal my gut with immunoglobulins and probiotics. And I take a bunch of minerals to adjunct, you know, those metabolic pathways to be able to get the B vitamins into the cells more properly. So everybody's a little different and every mutation can be a little bit different, you know, because of course we're all such unique bio-individual people. Mm-hmm. But for me, I generally start with healing through food. And so I would say the first thing you should do if you find out that you're positive for MTHFR is, you know, talk to somebody about what the best plan might be for you. It might be food. It might be supporting with B vitamins. It might be supporting with minerals. It might be doing a 21-day cleanse, like you said, to just kind of, you know, clean the pipes. Because sometimes that can be a huge problem is people have limited amount of receptors on their cells. So they can't even get the B vitamins in there because they're all gummed up with gluten or folic acid or other things that are really inflammatory that are, you know, mucking up the body's ability to even get the right constituents inside the cell.
Awesome.
Wow. That's awesome.
Have you found in your research any vaccinations that are safe out of all of them?
I really haven't. And I would be, I'm generally distrustful of convention. I will caveat sure. my statement sure. by saying I'm generally distrustful by convention with conventional medicine, you know, at this point in my career. So, but I don't know. And I think that, you know, the whole thing, if you say that one is safe, then what prevents you from saying that the rest of them are safe? So I think it's a matter of just being really mindful and making the right intention that you're going to support the body in a way that if God forbid they ever came across any of these, you know, pathogens, that the body would easily and effortlessly fight them off. Right. And so I think that's, you know, like we talk about, you know, like you said, natural immunity, natural immunization tends to be far more effective for the body.
That's our creator's vaccine for sure. And even my daughter that has the eczema currently, I nursed her till she was almost 2 years old. And Casey, I nursed till she was 20 months old. So I definitely gave them that natural vaccine that was passed down, you know, from my immunity that I had built. So to me, that's definitely father's vaccine for us. And that's all that we need. You can't perfect perfection.
No, you really can't. And the funny stories are, you know, in my practice where I have families that have four or five kids and, you know, have used breast milk, you know, for decades to, you know, treat ear infections and eye infections and this, that, and the other thing. And they finally, their family's complete and they've weaned their last baby and they call my office with like a 911 and they're like, what do I do? My kid has conjunctivitis and I'm not breastfeeding anymore. Like, how do I fix it?
That's wonderful. Well, I am just so honored to meet you and to interview you. And I'd love to do more of this because you definitely seem like you're a very wise naturopath.
Yeah, it's amazing that, you know, I deal a lot with the MDs that are outside the box. Yep. But it's really rare to meet a naturopath that's outside the box. They're usually the traditional foundational teachings from academia. Mm-hmm. So very rarely do they go outside the box with epigenetics. They don't talk about the genetic expressions as far as the epi versus genetics. They have germ theory in their head. That germ causes that. That virus causes that. That fungal form mm-hmm. causes that. We all know that pleomorphism is your answer, not monomorphic pathogens of Louis Pasteur. Well,
and you're absolutely right. I'm totally a terrain theorist. You know, let's clean up the environment. Forget about the germs. You know,
absolutely.
It's real simple.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Let's keep in touch. I know you're on our base camp group. I don't really participate a whole lot on that, but I keep an eye on it and we just adore you. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. I'm honored.
Awesome. Hopefully we can do this again.
That's for sure.
Yes, we're down to the last couple of minutes, so let me close out and we'll talk soon. You're listening to VIC, Vaccine Information Coalition Fellowship, and our shows can be accessed on the front page of our vacinfo.org website on the belly of a little boy flexing his muscles. We are on every Monday at 2 p.m., and our contact number is 800-939-8227. We thank Progressive Radio Network for allowing us to have this show, and y'all blessed to everybody.